hopefully many of you have had a relaxing time over the summer, or hopefully about to start one, and there's been time to catch up on some sleep after the year that was, I don't know, kind of the mental shock, really, of 2020. Our guest now has been part of a research team looking at sleep and why we need it. Van Savage is a professor in the Ecology and Evolutionary Biology and Biomathematics departments at the University of California, Los Angeles. The research team includes scientists with expertise in neuroscience, biology, statistics and physics. They conducted a comprehensive statistical analysis of sleep using data from more than 60 sleep studies involving humans and other mammals. This included total sleep time, REM, sleep time or REM sleep time, brain size and body size, and also the building and testing of a mathematical model to explain how sleep changes with brain and body size. Professor Savage says much of his work involves comparative studies across species.
I'm more on the mathematical and theoretical side than sort of the experimental side. This study we do is looking sort of the most recent study looking across development, so from birth to adult. An earlier study I did was a cross-species, more comparative study. And so my approach is I look at how lots of things vary with body size and body temperature across species. So, for example, why the heart rate of a whale is so much slower than that of a mouse. A mouse heart rate's way faster than ours, but a whale can go 1 or 2 minutes between heartbeats. Or why a whale's lifespan is so much longer than a mouse's. Or if you look at cell turnover time or time spent pregnant or any such marker of time or rates, typically the bigger an animal is, the longer the time scales are and the faster the rates are. The slower the rates are, the bigger it is. So I generally think about it from that perspective, sort of looking at across all of different species and all of biology, why do we see the differences in times and time scales that we see? And that's how I came to sleep, was I looked up sleep as one example, and sleep fascinated me because it's exactly opposite to almost every other time. Like I would say, that the bigger you are, generally the longer you live across species. A whale lives a lot longer. Some whales live perhaps even 200 years. But if you look at sleep, a whale sleeps only about an hour and a half per day, and it sleeps half the brain at a time. So the bigger things usually sleep a lot less than smaller things. So it goes the opposite direction of almost every other time we know in biology. So when I saw that, I was fascinated by the fact that sleep was so different and so opposite to everything else. And that gave me sort of like a window or a clue to start to think about how sleep was special and unusual, which that's how I came to the sort of questions I ask about it. And I think that's why it was sort of an outsider perspective on some of these questions.
Also, do you look mainly at data rather than sort of doing clinical tests and hypothesizing? Do you look at data as your primary mode of analysis?
Yes. Basically, there's a lot of people who do great clinical work and experimental work. And what I do is I try to gather those data from the literature as much as possible and look at them collectively and comprehensively. And along with that, write down mathematical equations connected to biological or physical principles we have, and then test those mathematical equations against the data to see what makes sense and what doesn't.
So,
and go ahead.
I was going to say, so what did the sleep study entail? How was it designed?
Right. So I'd say a couple of things about that. One thing I would say is that often people, when they collect these data, they do data analysis in the sense they say, if I look as we go from birth to adult, or I look across species, does sleep time tend to increase or decrease the body size? But that's sort of where the level of analysis stops. And coming from more of like a physics background, I sort of think we can do more than that, which is not just say, does it increase or decrease, but how fast does it increase and how fast does it decrease? And if we know that, can that tell us, for example, if we think sleep is for rest or for repair or for learning or for other things, does that affect how fast we expect it to increase or decrease? And can we use that rate of increase or decrease to distinguish between different theories or different hypotheses for the function of sleep. And also, from writing down the equations in the theory, one of the things it suggests, for example, is not just to plot sleep time versus body size, but to plot the ratio of sleep time over awake time. And actually, this is getting maybe too mathematical, but the logarithm, so sort of how things change over factors of 10 scale when you plot it. And that actually makes the data look much clearer and easier to understand. And I think if you just collect the data, you wouldn't know that's the right way to plot it. And that's why you really need some theory and some mathematical equations to guide the kind of ways you process and plot the data. So to get back to your original question, in terms of the planning for the study, our plan was to say, well, if we have ideas for the function of sleep, which they are out there in the literature, how can we write down a mathematical equation for that? How can we make a prediction for that? And then how can we actually take the data and test those predictions to sort of guide the data analysis in a more hypothesis-driven way, I guess I'd say.
So what are some of the leading hypotheses for why we sleep in general? And then we'll look at different age stages.
Mm-hmm. So in general, when I first started looking at these, I found this paper that said 100 theories for why we sleep. And it sort of cataloged 100 different theories for why we sleep, including very fine-grained subdivisions between them. But I would say over the past, say, 20 to 30 years, the leading ideas have been related to things like sleep being for repair, either of the whole body or the brain, sleep being for reorganization in the brain, meaning related to like learning and memory processing in the brain, sleep being related to immune system functioning. So if you're sick or you're injured, sleep being a time you can give more energy to fuel those things. Sleep also, you know, one of the things people often say is just for rest, which I could say more about that later if you want, but the idea is just, you know, literally just like using less energy for a little bit. Sleep, some related to memory and learning, some people say sleep is for forgetting. And I guess one other popular one that I can think of to say is the idea that sleep is actually a way, and like dreaming, for example, to explore new ideas, like to sort of say we have this like large, you know, if you're trying to solve a problem, for example, there's many ways you could try to solve it. And maybe in sleep, when we shut out all the noise and external stimulus coming into our body information, if we just shut down, our brain can focus and go more efficiently through processing all the different possible solutions to find the right solution. So those are sort of different flavors of the kinds of ideas for what sleep is for.
The so-called let's sleep on it hypothesis, the last one.
Exactly, that's right, exactly.
Well, let's look at how you approach it also, because you're looking at this also over the life cycle, right? So were you doing comparators, just to explain? Can we start with babies, for example, at that stage of life? What is theorized as the main activities attached to sleep in newborns, and what did you do with respect to that?
Right. So actually, one of the interesting things I would say is, and one of the, I think, the new pieces of our work is that people before, I think, hadn't really distinguished between maybe the sleep function depends on what your age you're at, that they think it's primarily for repair, primarily for learning, no matter what age you're at. And even when we started our study, honestly, that's how we were thinking about it. And we had looked at adults and we had found that sleep was mainly about repair. But then when we tried to apply those same ideas to sort of babies, we got very different results and it didn't agree with our previous ideas. And what we found was if we sort of reformulated and reworked the different possibilities, sleep being for learning and sort of changing connections in the brain became the most likely function in that early stage. And that actually does make a lot of sense for a variety of reasons that now in retrospect we see, which is that that you are changing lots of connections. I mean, we change connections even, I'm 46 now, I still change connections when I sleep, but very, very little compared to a baby or the first two or three years of life, you're growing lots of connections and pruning lots of connections in those first few years to learn how to walk and talk and language and everything else. So it's really a time of great sort of fluidity or plasticity in the brain. And also people have talked about, there's been evidence growing for a long time, including by one of my own co-authors in the study, Gina Poe, looking at the fact that during REM sleep, and some people say in non-REM sleep too, but REM sleep or sleep in general, that there's a lot of this activity going on to change the connections of the brain, either to strengthen connections, make them stronger, or to prune the connections. So, and if you look in, even before you get to our theory and our particular data analysis, I mean, it is true if you just look at the raw data for sleep, babies get a lot more REM sleep than we do as adults, not just the total amount, but proportionally. So for example, say a newborn baby might sleep 16 hours a day, whereas we sleep 7 or 8 hours a day. But if our 7 or 8 hours a day, we sleep about 10 to 15% of it is the REM sleep, which I should clarify as rapid eye movement sleep, which is when we're about to be dreaming. And it's like a deep sleep. But if you look at newborns, they have 50% of their rapid eye movement sleep is given to, is of total sleep is given to REM sleep. So for 16 hours, that means 8 hours of that they're giving doing REM sleep. Whereas for us, 7 or 8 hours a night sleep total, we're getting maybe a little over an hour of REM sleep. So so they really ramp up the REM sleep in those early stages. And now it kind of makes sense, especially if that's the stage when you're doing a lot of these connections and changes in the brain.
Now I'm wondering what newborns dream about.
That's a good question. And you know what's even interesting to me, and I didn't realize it till after we sort of almost had the paper published, and I met some people who looked at sleep not just in newborns, but actually before birth, sort of in the womb for fetuses. And apparently fetuses spend a lot of their time sleeping, maybe even the vast majority of their time sleeping. And so that, you know, raises the question of, you know, are they dreaming, which I would guess they probably are. And what are they dreaming about? I mean, because then it's even before you've had any stimulation. So, I mean, well, not any, but no external stimulation. So I think that's a great question. Like, what do newborn babies dream about? I wish we could ask them and know the answer, because I think that'd be fascinating.
Has this got implications for the old never wake a sleeping baby? And, of course, there's, you know, a lot of different approaches on routine with feeding, but this suggests, do we let them run their sleep as much as possible?
I would say yes. I mean, we all have to live our lives, and sometimes there's just no way to avoid waking a sleeping baby. But I would say if you can't avoid it, you definitely should, because I would say that actually is really valuable to their development. I think getting a lot of sleep and getting a lot of REM sleep is helping them make the changes in their brain they need to make to develop. So I would say you should help a baby get as much sleep as possible and try not to wake them as much as possible. And I say that, but I always give the caveat that I don't want to make people worried if their baby doesn't sleep well, because I have a son who is now almost 7, and he was not a good sleeper. I worried his son, but he's turned out well. So I don't want to make people worried if their baby is not sleeping well. But I would say if your baby is sleeping and sleeping well, you should let them go at it and not try to disturb them.
What did you learn about what happens around the age of 2.5?
So essentially that's one of the coolest parts of our study as well, is that 2.5 is when you see this huge shift or transition in basically the function of sleep, where before 2.5, it seems like it's mostly about changing connections in the brain and learning. And after 2.5, it seems to quickly transition to be more about repairing neurons in the brain. And the reason I'll say repair is so important for the brain is because we don't replace neurons. So sort of the ones we have are the ones we're stuck with. And our metabolism produces lots of free radicals and other damaging agents that do hurt the proteins and DNA in the cell. And so sort of neurons are different than, say, skin, which we replace all the time. So we sort of have to repair the cells that's there. And it seems like sleep is one of the ways we do that repair. And I'm not surprised that repair, actually, I should say that in retrospect, I'm not surprised and repair, the repair becomes important by the time we're adults. But I was shocked, and even now I'm still a little surprised, to be honest with you, that it happened so early, that switch, that it's before 2.5 is we're really doing something quite different in terms of the dominant function of sleep than after 2.5. And I would not have guessed before we did the study at all that it happens so early. But I guess for language and things like that, that's a hugely important time. And learning language and other brain developmental things that have movement. So it's surprising to me, but maybe if I was studied development of babies more, it wouldn't have been as shocking to me.
Also, that pruning that you talk about, that pruning process, I wonder if that is very heavily focused in that early couple of years, the actual sort of biological and physiological pruning that's going on. Were you able to determine that when that peaks?
That is. So you can look at basically what's called synapse formation and synapse pruning, and that's sort of the connections that happen between different neurons. And that does seem to like sort of peak and then decay really a lot in the first 2.5 years. So it is consistent. And I guess I kind of knew that before the study, but never appreciated like how dramatic it is and how really early it is. And in the paper, we make the analogy of sort of like water freezing to ice, where before the phase transition, water molecules move all around. And when they're frozen, they sort of can only move a little bit around with their nearest neighbors. And that's kind of the analogy we're making to the brain, that in that period before 2.5, your neurons' connections are changing all around for who they're talking to and interacting with. But then after 2.5, they're more frozen into place. It's not that they can't change, but they change much more slowly.
This was across species too, this dynamic.
So from the data we have across species, it's consistent with it. And we certainly have a lot of data across species in adults that shows sleep is for repair for adults. For development, we had a handful of species, like a guinea pig and a cat, that I would say are consistent with these ideas. But I'd love, in working with people who are more on the lab and clinical side, to get even more fine-grained focused data for other animals and see what happens, both to see if the switch is as dramatic in those other species and to say, well, maybe it happens. Does it happen at the analogous age of 2.5, or does it happen like, you know, right at birth or longer? Because some animals, you know, are much more mature when they're born than humans are. So I'd be really curious to look at it. Even the cross species results are consistent, but I'd love to even dig deeper on that and see exactly how perfect of a match it is.
Van Savage is our guest, professor in the Ecology and Evolutionary Biology and Biomathematics departments at the University of California, LA. We're talking about his research team's deep dive, really, into what we know about why we sleep and how that changes. You're listening to 9 to Noon on RNZ National. Of course, when we are sleeping, brain activity is still going on. We've talked about the REM dreaming, dream time, rapid eye movement, dream time. You brought up that question of rest earlier. What kind of brain activity is continuing, and how much constitutes lower activity or rest relative to when we are conscious or fully awake?
Right. That's a very good question. So, for example, in the rapid eye movement or the REM movement sleep, when you're dreaming, your brain is very active. Like, you've cut off sort of the signals to send to your body to, like, not move and flail and walk around while you sleep, at least most people. Like, sleepwalking happens, but most of the time you've cut off the signal stress to your body, so your body's not moving around as much. But your brain metabolism activity is actually very high. And your brain is the most metabolically, energetically expensive organ in your body, like 20% of your total power you use. That's actually eating up quite a lot of energy. So even like, I think probably even 30 to 40 years ago, I remember reading quotes by sleep researchers who were arguing against sleep being for rest and saying essentially if you just sat down in a chair all night without moving, so you just, you know, you did lie down, but you didn't actually have to sleep, that you would save almost as much energy as if you slept. And I think the calculation difference for humans was that, like, the difference of energy you save by sleeping versus not might be equal to, like, a hot dog bun or a glass of milk. So it's not zero, but it's not huge. And that's been one of the arguments given against sleep being primarily for rest, that actually, even though our body's not moving around, that saves us some energy, our brain actually is still really active, and there is a lot of power being used.
I'm just thinking, though, are there fewer external stimuli coming in? In other words, is the brain doing whatever it wants to do instead of internal stimulus catching its attention?
I think that that is, I think what at least my understanding is that you're, I think we're able to direct that energy use and power use and brain activity to things like this internal states and internal stimulus and internal processing instead of the external states. So I think shutting off that external does let us direct that brain energy and power towards internal things we need to do. I think that is true.
What did you learn about sleep deprivation? I'm curious, by the way, just to what some of these 60 studies have actually done over the years to people to research them. But we all know how chronic and debilitating and painful even chronic sleep deprivation is. It's an extraordinarily powerful response. What have we learned about why that is?
So I guess that's a good question, and I agree with you. It is having, especially like I said, my son was young, it is like debilitating, it's painful. And I think essentially our brain's not able to do the repair and the processing it needs to do to keep up with the power we're using and the incoming stimulation. And it does just sort of like degrade and wear down our brain. And I think that, there's lots of analogies to that, like being drunk or on different drugs or medication. If this is how it affects your reaction times, your learning, your ability to think clearly, it's a big effect. And I also think because our body knows it's very important and has evolved for it to be very important, we have actually specific genes that turn on and proteins that work to try to make us go to sleep. There are specific genes and proteins trying to say your brain needs to sleep, and it's telling you need to go to sleep. And if you aren't, then you're fighting that, and basically you're fighting against this drive within your own body to do that sleep, and that also has the effect of just sort of like in this sort of I guess I'd call it like an internal fight in your body, or not listening to your body when it's trying to make you go to sleep.
What happens now? Because you've looked for patterns, essentially. Is that the best way of describing what you've done across all these studies? And what where do you take that from here?
So one of the a couple a few things we want to take from here. One is I already mentioned the idea of looking more carefully at these same sorts of questions and more species and with more data points versus age and other species. Another is I sort of briefly alluded to too, which is looking sort of even before birth, like at fetuses in the womb to see how much they're sleeping. Does that continue this sort of the sort of pattern that we see for sleeping for processing and learning and changing connections? Or is it even something different happening there before birth? And then another one I'm excited about right now is I mentioned that sort of where I come from, I think about how do biological times change the body size and body temperature. And all the data we've looked at so far are for mammals, which are all at a constant temperature. But there are lots of things that sleep that are ectotherms or cold-blooded, so their temperature changes. So I'm really interested to see if temperature changes sleep patterns. And there's a paper that came out in the past year, maybe year and a half, where they show for fruit flies, so Drosophila across the globe, they do see some effects that warmer, ones raised at warmer temperatures or evolved at warmer temperatures versus colder temperatures do get different amounts of sleep. So one thing I think I'd love to do is to try to say, well, if we have data for temperature differences across species, can we say like which ones sleep more or which ones sleep less? And what does that say about the function of sleep in these animals? And I should say also for fruit flies, a different very cool study that came out in the past year is one that shows for fruit flies during sleep, it seems like they are doing repair. Like we said, for humans, we're doing repair in the brain, or mammals, we think that's the case overall. But it was arguing that for the flies, it's about repair, but actually more repair in the gut. So also looking at something like that, is it about repair in the gut or the brain? So even expanding beyond mammals to look at other species, and even think about how temperature effects could affect sleep patterns as well.
I'm curious also in the field of biomathematics, are you looking also across various fields of study, not just sleep, at how you determine what is optimal, what is average, what is optimal, what varies so much from the average that it becomes negative or disturbed? Is this a way of working out for each of us, perhaps, ultimately, mm-hmm. how much sleep is right for each of us, or how much anything else might be right for each of us? Does this get to the sort of heart of the way you approach some of your work?
It does, and it is along the lines of what you're saying. I should say again, I sort of was trained in physics and then went to biology, and to contrast those two fields, and there's a lot of excellent people doing excellent work in both. I think in physics, the sort of mindset's often like, how do I find the average pattern that describes like most of what's happening? Whereas in biology, sometimes the sort of mindset's more like, it's really interesting and cool to understand how evolution has affected different species to make them exceptional or unusual in some way. And what I want to do is sort of say, those aren't opposed or contradictory. It's more like, from a physicist's perspective, you have to understand the average pattern or the sort of the baseline effect to then say, okay, that's sort of what we expect, but then what deviates from that? And then if we can find what deviates from that strongly, what's like a big exception to that, and try to understand why it's a big exception to that. And that's sort of true across species. But as you say, over the past 10 years, I've tried to extend that more to thinking about even humans and human disease, and comparing things like tumor and the blood vessels, the blood vessel network in tumors versus blood vessels and blood vessel networks in our sort of more healthy tissue. And then also, for example, sleep, like we're talking about right now, that there is going to be some variation in how much we sleep. Like it might be, 6 to 9 hours is, can be acceptable depending on, all kinds of factors, really. But, 3 to 4 hours is just too little. And when you're a baby, we could say this much REM sleep or this much sleep is just too little. There is variation. Not every baby is going to get the exact same amount of hours of sleep. But this is the variation you expect. And if you go too far away from that, then we do have reason to be concerned and look more carefully at it.
Van Savage, professor in the Ecology, Evolutionary Biology and Biomathematics departments at UCLA, on the big meta-study he did effectively into sleep.